This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Ezekiel Emanuel says that we live too long and have overinvested in life-extending treatments and technologies. He's one of the country's leading healthcare experts, heads the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, and is director of the Clinical Bioethics Department at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. His provocative article in The Atlantic, Why I Hope to Die at 75, has kicked up some controversy. He says that when he turns 75, which is almost 20 years from now, he will decline medical treatments, screenings, and tests. People have criticized Emanuel because of his bleak description of old age, the relentless loss of cognitive, physical, and imaginative functioning. Doing crossword puzzles and listening to books on tape are not his vision of a fulfilling life. He'd rather be climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. We were interested in talking more, and we asked Zeke Emanuel to join us once again on Radio Times. You're down there in D.C. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here again.
So why 75? Why is that a kind of magic number for you?
Well, when I look at the data, both of the physical disabilities as well as dementia and the loss of creativity, the inevitable mental slowing down, I just find that it's sort of the age where the risks are minimum and you've had a fulfilling life. If you die before that, you know, it's a problem. But I think it's more than a problem. It's a tragedy. But if you die at 75, you've had a complete life, a rich life, and hopefully you've avoided any of the disabilities.
Well, that's almost 18, I think it's 2032 for you when you turn 75. I mean, how do you even know at the age of, 57, 58, what you're going to be like at 75, what you're going to even want at that age?
Well, I don't know, but I think the issue is less what I want and what's a really meaningful life. And that is something you can think about now.
Looking at the title of your piece, which is Why I Hope to Die at 75. Are we okay?
I need to clarify something. I didn't pick the title.
Well, I wanted to ask you that because that's actually not what your article is about. You don't want to die at age 75.
Correct. And I expect to be alive and I hopefully functioning.
What you're going to do, at least what you say in this article you're going to do at 75, is that if you, for instance, get a diagnosis of cancer, you're not going to get treatments for it. You're just going to sort of let it take its course. What else are you not going to do at 75?
I try to be pretty clear in the article that what I'm going to do is not go to the doctor and not take treatments where the reason for the treatment is going to make you live longer. I do say clearly that if I had sort of pain or I had other problems like shortness of breath, that I would get palliative treatments. But I'm not looking for life-extending treatments, and I'm going to refuse life-extending treatments. So that's the distinction. I also make very clear in the article, for more than 25 years now, I've been in public and pretty strident about being against the legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide. So I'm not going to exit by those means, and I don't actually endorse their legalization. I don't think that's the right conversation to be having.
I'm sure, read a lot of the criticisms, at least some of the criticisms of your article, and some of it has to do with your depiction of old age, the idea that if you're 80 years old, you won't be playing tennis, you won't be traveling, it's this horrible decline as you describe it. What is your vision of old age?
Well, first of all, that isn't what I say in the article. I am a pretty data-driven guy, and so I look at the data, recognizing full well that we live collectively across a spectrum, and I say many times in the article, these are statistical averages.
Right.
Any individual is going to deviate from the average, but if you look at the average, it's an average for a reason. Most of us are going to be like that. Most of us are not going to be outliers by definition. And if you look at the data, the chance of physical disability is both high and increasing. Dementia by 85, 33% to 50% of people have Alzheimer's dementia. The loss of creativity is substantial. You have to look very, very hard to identify a few people who are literally creative after 75, and they're by definition really extreme outliers. That just is the way the world is. Can anyone, and typically before I wrote the article, when I would talk with people about these ideas, the first reaction is, oh, but you know, my aunt who's 101 and perfectly copus mentis, or this person who keeps contributing. And I, as I say in the article, you know, one of my great collaborators out at Stanford is still active, just turned 90 in February. So I recognize that there are outliers. I've actually benefited from intellectual and research collaboration with them. But I also recognize they are unique outliers. They are not the run of the mill. And we need to be clear, because we can identify a few people out there, even thousands of people out there, doesn't make that the norm. The norm is much more likely to be some physical disability, mental disability, a slowing of mental functions, and a loss of creativity. That is, I mean, that's just the way nature works. And I think to say, oh, no, that's not right because I can find one or two people mm-hmm. who are not like that, that doesn't prove anything.
Well, and I'm not trying to prove one thing one way or the other. I think that it seems clear, and this article is really, it's about you. It's about, you're not saying that
it's a personal article.
It's a very personal article, and I appreciate that. But what I got from the article is that you are not interested in doing crossword puzzles or listening to books on tape, and being confined, let's say, to a wheelchair. That is something you do not want.
So let me say two things. One of the reasons for writing the article and putting out my personal view is to ask people to think about their personal view, is to challenge people, what is meaningful in your life? What will make your life worth it at the end? And, you know, for me, it's quite clear, mm-hmm. and I make clear, I think, in the article, it's not about clocking up the number of years. It's not about trying to just increase that number as much as possible. That is what I call the American Immortals goal, you know, living as long as possible. I think most of us say, you know, we really care about quality of life. And so I'm asking people, just define quality of life. How does that intersect with quantity of life? And I think, you know, once you've gotten to 75, you've lived a very, very complete life. You've, you know, been a young kid, you've grown up, you've perfected your capacities, you've educated yourself, then you've had an adult life where you've been able to play those out and make your contributions through kids, through community, through whatever professional aspirations you've had. And then you've moved on to another phase where you're sort of a mentor and a loving parent and a loving grandparent. And that's great. What I don't want, and mm-hmm. what I think most people don't want, is then to become a kind of burden, in the sense that, you know, your physical abilities are declining, your mental abilities are declining. I want my kids to remember me as vigorous, engaged, fun, not as frail and debilitated. And that is a very important thing for me, how my kids experience me. And I think the longer a person lives disabled or frail, the more that memory dominates. I got an interesting email from the daughter of a patient I treated in the 90s. A lovely patient. She had chronic myelogenous leukemia, and I treated her for about 6 years. Just great. She was still teaching in the school. She went from teaching to being a substitute teacher, and she was vigorous. And then when she was 70, her disease progressed and she died. And the daughter writes to me that, you know, I thought that was a tragedy. Mom was so vibrant, and then her life was cut short. And then my father, he lived and just died a few years ago at 82 and had Parkinson's disease. And then I realized that, Dr. Emanuel, your view was right. That those years of living with him with Parkinson's disease, it was much better that mom died, even if it was early in the prime of life and vibrant, rather than my experiencing the decline and burdens and just the changed person of her father. I think that's a very common experience and view. You know, that's not everyone's. That's one portion. Lots of people want to live as long as possible. That's how we have, and I'm related to one of those people. But, you know, I don't think that, I'm challenging people, what would make your life meaningful?
Well, and you raise a number of issues there. One is, do you feel that you, once you hit 75, that you will have some degree of control over your death, however that comes?
Well, what I will have control over is whether I go to the doctor or not, and
yes,
that's what I say. And none of us can really control our death. I mean, I guess you can control it if you do euthanasia, which I don't. But you do have control over whether you take medical treatments or not, whether you go for medical screenings or not, and I'm going to exercise that control.
You also say, and as you said, this is a very personal article, and this is the second line, this preference drives my daughters crazy. You say you don't want your children and grandchildren to remember you as an old, infirmed man, but it sounds like they see this very differently.
So my daughters have known about my view since they've been in diapers. So we've had these discussions. And they, you know, as one of my daughters just the other day said, you know, I fully expect you, Dad, to be, you know, completely vigorous and going full force at 75. So I'm not taking this too seriously. And we joke about them pushing me in a wheelchair down the highway. We have a variety of conversations about it. And, you know, they I will say the one thing that they never doubt is that I'm serious. We've had a lot of – I mean, they understand my philosophy, and even if they don't agree with it, they do understand it's my philosophy and that I am quite serious. And they often say to people who doubt, well, as you get closer to 75,
right,
you know, no doubt you'll change your mind. I think they're very happy to take that bet for many people because I don't think they think that chance is probably pretty low.
Well, about a minute before our first break here, and just quoting from the very end of your article, you say, and I retain the right to change my mind and offer a vigorous and reasoned defense of living as long as possible. That, after all, would still mean being creative at 75. So if at 75 you still feel great, you want to live, that's because you feel this kind of vitality that you're afraid you're going to lose?
I always want to be open-minded, but I think this isn't a view I came to in the last few weeks or the last few months or even the last few years. I've been thinking about this for decades.
Well, we're talking with Ezekiel Emanuel in this hour of Radio Times. His provocative article in The Atlantic is titled, Why I Hope to Die at 75, although as we have been talking about what's in the article, it's really that when he turns 75, as he sees it now, he wants to decline medical treatments and screenings and tests and wants to let, in a sense, nature take its course. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of this idea? How would this apply in your life? Also, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. So stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Anishinaabe Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Anishinaabe is currently presenting the spy thriller Ciphers by English playwright Dawn King, directed by Tom Ring. Ciphers on stage now through October 26th at the Off Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center joins you in supporting WHYY. With over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center is committed to delivering advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
supporting WHYY's Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Dallingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. Special services for respite memory care are offered for a limited time for families who need support for loved ones during the upcoming holiday season. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel about his article in The Atlantic. He says that after the age of 75, when the quality of life begins to diminish, he will have lived a complete life. He will have loved, been loved, seen his children grow up, and will have fulfilled his professional goals. He will decline all medical treatments, and he will be content with his decision as he sees it now. As he said, an idea that is not new to him, something he's been thinking about for a long time now. This article has gotten a lot of play, a lot of pushback, a lot of conversation, and that's why we invited him to join us on Radio Times. He is one of the country's leading healthcare experts, heads up the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Zeke, one of the things you say in here, which I thought was really interesting, I thought all of it was actually very interesting, is that we have invested so much time and technology and treatments in extending life and making life, people live many, many years longer than they did in the past. You say it's really time to invest that time and energy and technology for children and what happens at the beginning of life. Talk about that for a bit.
Well, since the mid-19th century, we have been having the life expectancy expand. And early in the 20th century, the main change was to get rid of childhood deaths and to really have a decrease in childhood deaths and improve births with fewer deaths before five. We got vaccines, we got antibiotics, and we really made getting through childhood much, much more likely. And that, you know, tremendously increased life expectancy, and it our treatments and our vaccines really meant that kids, if they got sick or we prevented them from getting sick, actually were normal and lived a complete and normal life. Now, as I quote one of the country's leading demographers, you know, what we've done since roughly 1960 is extend the dying process. We've really focused a lot of our attention and resources on extending the life of people with chronic illnesses like heart disease or stroke or cancer. And I say, you know, while this is a very personal view, there are some policy implications, and one policy implication I suggest is we should stop celebrating and focusing on extending the average life expectancy. I note that earlier in this week, the CDC just announced that we have record-breaking life expectancy, and I said we should really not pay attention to that. That should not be something that we're really focused on. We should instead focus on younger kids, and I identify three targets that I think are really important. One is to reduce the premature births, births that happen before 37 weeks. They're filled with problems, physical, mental, developmental problems, and I think we need to cut those down. Right now, they're about 12 or 15% of all births are before 37 weeks, and we really need to reduce that number. Similarly, we need to reduce the infant mortality rate. Our infant mortality rate is nearly three times that of, say, Japan or Norway, at about over 6 per 1,000 births. We really can do a lot better, and we need to focus on that. And the third area, which I think has gotten almost no attention and I think is pretty tragic, is we have a very high adolescent death rate, whether by accidents or suicides or firearms, and we really need to reduce that. We should not be the developed world's leading country with the highest death rate among adolescents. So I would say let's refocus our energies on improving the health and well-being of our young people. Mm-hmm. That's really that's one of the policy implications. I say another policy implication here is to really double down on the disabilities of old age and ameliorating them and even preventing them, and similarly for Alzheimer's.
Well, and this is from my own personal experience dealing with relatives in old age, and oftentimes in the hospital in old age, it's so hard to say no to this new technology, you know, these life-extending technologies. You sometimes have to get yourself into a fight with a doctor, a hospital, in order to fulfill someone's wishes, for instance.
Yeah, just let me make 2 points about that. The first is I recount in the article one of my experiences about that. I'm not a wallflower, as probably certainly as you know, Marty,
know
and
as most of your
most of your guests know. But I ended up having a 10-minute argument with a urologist about getting me a PSA, a prostate cancer screening test. I didn't want it. I don't like the test. I think it's got more harms than benefits for individual patients. He insisted on it, and we had a 10-minute back and forth about it. And in the end, he got the blood, he got the test, and I told him I didn't want the result because you weren't getting the test for me. I didn't want it. But yes, it can be very difficult to get doctors to listen to you and to not use the technology that is available. And I also, as I've seen in my practice and in my experience, probably the hardest decision is around antibiotics. Mm. You know, I've over my years caring for patients, seen a lot of patients who have Alzheimer's or have severe physical disabilities, and they get an infection, and people feel like, well, I can't not give them the antibiotics. Of course, you know, you can not give them the antibiotics, but that's a very hard decision for people to make. I think that turns out to be probably the critical one. And again, my view of not taking antibiotics is sort of consistent with, I quote Sir William Osler, probably the greatest 20th century physician, considered, you know, a demigod among doctors. He's the guy who started Johns Hopkins Medical Service. He was just a brilliant physician and a brilliant commentator on human life. You know, dying of pneumonia, relatively quick, relatively painless, and you know he's known to have called it the old man's friend, and I think we need to rethink that. Rethink, you know, we don't need to do everything for everyone. We should be much more judicious in the use. And I would say the one thing which sort of encourages me on this point is a lot of the healthcare providers, physicians, and nurses who've responded to the article agree with me. And so at least for them personally, my philosophy seems to resonate. I think it's important for them to take that personal agreement and actually apply it to their patients, or at least open the conversation with their patients. Not all of their patients, of course, will agree with me, but I think it's important to be open to that conversation.
Well, I do want to have a conversation with some of our callers, but I got the feeling reading the article, your concerns about losing, you know, your physical abilities, your physical functioning, your cognitive abilities as well. But it seemed as your concern about the loss of your creative abilities seemed to be the one that haunts you the most. Do I have that right?
I think all of them haunt me. But yeah, look, as I joke with people, I'm already on the downward side of the graph. If you look at the graph,
join
the
club,
article,
by the way.
I mean, there's you know, people who've researched creativity, and again, these are statistical averages. Individuals often break these rules, but you know, you start a career, and about 20 years into the career, sometime in, you know, between 40, 45, or 50, depending on when your career really starts, you're at the peak. You're at the peak of creativity. You're at the peak of productivity. And then there's a pretty consistent, and actually this consistent decline is typically independent of the area you work in, whether it's physics or literature. It's also culturally independent. And as I've said before, if you actually look at a large pool of people, it's very hard to find people who continue to be creative with new ideas, new thoughts after 75. I mean, there are lots of people who have been identified to me. My philosopher friends will identify Immanuel Kant. He didn't start going until he was 57, and I know, yeah, and he ended at 73. Nothing was written after 73. And then, you know, there are two people who in history have sort of maintained creativity past 75, and Goethe and Verdi are the two ones who are consistently identified in that category. But, you know, I also note that one of my collaborators has maintained his creativity into the late 80s and 90 years old now. So it's possible. It's just rare.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about an article in The Atlantic that has provoked a lot of conversation. He says when he reaches the age of 75, which is the year, is it 2032? So it's a little ways off.
It's 2032.
Off, 2032. He is going to say no to treatments and to tests and to screenings and basically let life or perhaps let death take its course without intervention. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And I should say, we already have a lot of people that want to talk to you, Zeke Emanuel. No surprise there. Let me get Allison from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Allison. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a 96-year-old relative who had worked until she was her 86th birthday, went to work 5 days a week, had made a decision a long, long time ago to avoid doctors, mainly because she did not trust them. Ended up having a minor stroke when she was 94, and despite the fact that she had a living will that stated that she was to have no extraordinary interventions and so forth and so on, lingers still, is nearly aphasic. One of the things that she ignored, because she was afraid to address it, she said, was a tumor in a breast, which by the time it was discovered at the time she was admitted for this stroke was about the size of a croquet ball and now has covered almost her entire chest. It bleeds, it itches, it does all kinds of things. And this has been going on now since...
Oh, we seem to have lost Allison. I'm not sure. I mean, she's telling us a very poignant story, Ezekiel Emanuel, about what sounds like a very vigorous person. She had a stroke and now, you know, is living a much more diminished life. And it also sounds like she didn't want this for herself. And this is something we touched on earlier, which is you know, how much control do we have over the end of our lives?
Right. First of all, it does sound as if she... has been caught in a very unfortunate circumstance and really somewhat tragic circumstance, not one she wanted. But I think it does emphasize, you know, especially in the United States, especially with our belief in individualism and autonomy, that we can control everything. We clearly can't control everything, and things happen to us. Sometimes they're good things that happen to us, but sometimes, as in this case, they can be really, really tragic things that happen to people, and it's really unfortunate.
Indeed. Allison, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm sorry we got cut off there. I was looking at some of these statistics, Zeke, about how long people are living these days. And for women, I think it's something like 81.1 years. For men, it's 76 and some change. So this 75 marker point, for at least for you and for men, that seems like that might be the time at which you're going to die anyway, if I can put it like that.
Again, those are averages, and there's a big Bell distribution. Some people, and probably the best predictor of living longer are higher education and higher income. That's right around the time of life expectancy. I will say that, you know, there are groups that haven't made it to 75 on average.
Right.
Black males are the most obvious one, and I do think that is not acceptable. And it's not like I say in the article or the policy implication here is, you know, we should ignore trying to extend life for everyone. Black males, again, largely lower education, lower income, and obviously not getting what the healthcare system has to offer. We do need to address that disparity, and that is, in my view, a totally unethical and unacceptable disparity. So I don't want people to interpret my view about 75 as saying, well, you know, we don't have to worry about particular groups that haven't made it to 75.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. You're one of the architects, if I can say, of the Affordable Care Act. And we all know, it seems like, you know, almost a century ago when it was still being written and being discussed, there were all these talks about death panels and people went crazy. Of course, there were no death panels. But nonetheless, are you trying to get us as a nation to think more, sort of more with more clearly and more even intellectually about what our life and what our death is going to be about?
Marty, I think most Americans actually would like to have a mature discussion about end-of-life care and about how we live. That's what all the polling data says, and actually most people, when I go out and talk and give public addresses, that is a very big concern for them. Death panels, obviously, was just demagogic and completely ridiculous attack and an attempt to torpedo the Affordable Care Act. I have been working. I started out my career in the mid-1980s as a lowly medical student, then intern, focused on trying to improve end-of-life care, because when I got onto the wards as a medical student, I said, you know, we're not treating these people right or well. At that time, the medical community was not very receptive. When I went off to do a PhD in the area, you know, one of my deans basically said, good luck. It's a sort of career ender. The healthcare establishment, that's not a primary focus for us. Well, I think it is a primary focus. It clearly has become a primary focus. And I think a lot of Americans want to have a mature discussion about it. And again, part of the motivation for writing this article was not to have that discussion as a policy discussion, because I think it's more important to have it as a personal discussion, a discussion, you know, what do you want out of life? That's really what I'm asking. What is important to you? Is it living a long time? Is it doing something remarkable, memorable? Is it raising wonderful kids and grandchildren? Is it really building your community? I'm sure, you know, to some degree, all of those are important for people. And I think they are really not very clearly related to living, you know, as long as you possibly can. They're living, you know, living a complete life, but 75 is certainly a complete life. And I think a lot of people, you know, certainly the letters, some of the letters at least, coming back on the article is, you know, I don't want to be in my 90s where all my friends have died and I'm, you know, frail and dependent and maybe even a burden on my family. That's not what many people want, and I've tried to put voice to that perspective. And I recognize, as I often say, you know, this is a personal view. It's not the view everyone's going to have, but what I would like is for everyone to have that discussion, for us to go forward into our older age thoughtfully, not just do it habitually.
Do you think we have a bit of a window, about a minute before our second break here, but a bit of a window because the Affordable Care Act has been passed? We've hopefully gotten past these death panel things that we can maybe have this conversation. And this is something we've talked about on Radio Times for a long time. And I agree with you. I think people do want to talk about it. They don't maybe know how, or it's a scary kind of a conversation. Quickly,
well, it's interesting. In the middle of the 19th century, most people had experienced death of a child or a spouse or a brother. Today, you know, most of us don't experience a personal death. Both my parents are alive, my siblings are alive, my children are alive. You know, I've experienced it because I've been a doctor to cancer patients. Mm-hmm. But that makes it harder to have that conversation when it's not part of our daily experience. And I do think people nonetheless realize their mortality. They are going to die, and they want it to be in a way that is meaningful to them and not just hooked up to all sorts of machines. And I think that is very, very important to almost everyone in our society, and we need to begin having that conversation. And it takes time, and so we can't do it in a soundbite.
And that's Ezekiel Manuel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about an article in The Atlantic about the fact that when he reaches the age of 75, he doesn't want medical treatments, he doesn't want tests, he doesn't want screenings, he wants to just let nature take its course. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Breast Center of Doylestown Hospital is proud to support WHYY, offering personalized care plans and advanced surgical techniques, including the newest type of breast-conserving surgery. The specialists of the Breast Center of Doylestown Hospital are your resource for comprehensive breast care close to home. Pink Party, a breast health event in Warrington, Pennsylvania on Monday, October 13th, will feature a health discussion, therapy demonstrations, refreshments, and more. Details at dh.org/pinkparty.
Mural Arts Month supports WHYY. Running throughout the month of October, this celebration of public art includes a photo exhibition, mural dedications, tours, and artist talks centered around the theme of Art Ignites Change. On Tuesday, October 14th, WHYY will host Mural Lab Live, an intimate evening with eight people who understand the role of art in improving the civic landscape of cities. More, including the entire schedule of events, is available online at muralarts.org/artignites.
The College of Nursing at Villanova University offers a Doctor of Nursing Practice program designed for advanced practice nurses and nurse administrators. With full or part-time options and rolling admission, Villanova's online DNP includes on-campus seminars and interdisciplinary faculty who support you in translating nursing science to improve healthcare outcomes. Cohorts start each June. Villanova's Doctor of Nursing Practice program supports WHYY. Villanova.edu/nursing/DNP.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. If you're just joining us, bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel is our guest today on Radio Times, talking about a provocative article he wrote in The Atlantic, saying basically when he reaches the age of 75, he will have lived a complete life and he doesn't want medical interventions. He believes that it's pretty much downhill after that with the loss of physical and cognitive functioning. There's been a fair amount of reaction to what he has written. It is provocative, and it does raise a whole host of, I think, very important questions about how we want to live our lives and how we want to think about the end of our life. And Ezekiel Emanuel is the chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Zeke, I wanted to ask you about something, and this is, as you say in this article, you do not believe in euthanasia. You don't. You oppose physician-assisted suicide. There's a young woman named Brittany Maynard, and she has a prescription in her wallet written by a doctor in Oregon, one of the five states with legal protections for terminally ill patients who want to end their suffering. I'm reading here from the Washington Post. In 3 weeks, she plans to use it to die. She has brain cancer. Looks like she's going to die, you know, within the next couple of months anyway. But she wants to control her death. I'm curious about what you think about her decision.
Well, let's put her decision aside for a second. I have done a lot of research and a lot of thinking about euthanasia and assisted suicide. So let me just identify a few points. First of all, if you look at the people who are interested in euthanasia and assisted suicide, and we did this original research in the early 1990s, and it's been confirmed here in the United States and in the Netherlands, where they were quite skeptical of our results, we showed that the leading reason and the leading motivation for people who were interested in assisted suicide was not extreme pain, mm-hmm. which is what we almost all think, but actually it's about depression, hopelessness, and this desire for control. Now, our immediate reaction to people who are depressed and hopeless is not, oh, here's a set of pills, go and kill yourself. So it seems to me that we need to think of euthanasia and assisted suicide more like suicide and less like a good death. It's really about people reacting with depression and hopelessness. And as I said, the Dutch thought, you know, that can't be right. That's true in America where it's not legal, but it's not true in the Netherlands. In fact, they redid the study and it was true in the Netherlands just as much. So I don't think the proper reaction to someone who's depressed or hopeless is, you know, a pile of pills. The second thing I would say
Let me just stop you there because
Let me just finish
the next thing, which is
very important, which is even in the Netherlands, where it's been legalized for decades now and very socially accepted, a very, very, very small minority of people actually even think about euthanasia-assisted suicide or end their life with assisted suicide or euthanasia. Maximum is about 3% of the 3% of the people who die. Mm-hmm. That means 97% of the people, this isn't about what they're interested in. And I'm always, again, as the article makes clear, I'm a data-driven guy. If you're really interested in improving end-of-life care, if you're really interested in trying to get a good life and a good last chapter and a good death for people, you know, it's not about euthanasia and assisted suicide. It's about all the other stuff that we've been talking about, conversations with family, conversations with doctors. Can you find me a case, an anecdote where, you know, it's really about euthanasia or assisted suicide that's really going to make it better? Sure. Does that actually tell us what we ought to be doing? No. And I'm interested in trying to get people to think about the right things to be doing both personally and from a policy standpoint. And from my view, from the policy standpoint, legalization of euthanasia-assisted suicide is not the way to go.
Well, and I hear all of that. I'm not a data-driven guy at all. This is more I'm an anecdotal-driven person. But can you, though, understand that, you know, that 3% of people that say, I want the kind of control that you want over the end of your life. I mean, it's different. But nonetheless, I want to have some control over how I'm going to end my days on this planet. And I am going to choose with full, you know, I'm not depressed. I have full cognitive functioning. This is something that I'm going to choose for myself. Can you make room for that small exception?
I don't think it, you know, my view on this is that small exception is not a rationale for a big policy change. I think the lawyers have a phrase, you know, extreme cases make bad laws and bad policies. I can recognize with you that there may be some exceptions like that, but I think from a, again, this is Zeke Emanuel, health policy person. From a policy standpoint, that's probably not the best approach. And I, you know, I personally also think, again, from the cases and experiences I know, you know, when someone commits suicide, it tends to leave a memory that you don't want to leave, which is, you know, with the family, how did we fail? What more could we have done? Were they depressed? Were they hopeless? Could we have done other things? That's not the memory I want to leave my kids. I want to leave my kids of, you know, I've had a great life. I've loved you. You've loved me. That's fantastic. You know, just remember all these great experiences we had together, this fun, these, you know, hard things we solved together. Remember Dad is sort of this vigorous, playful guy. That's, I think, the key memory. When you commit suicide, it tends to change what people remember.
But and I do want to get back to our callers here, but I'm also thinking, I mean, the things that you don't want to experience as an older person, which is a loss of cognitive functioning, the loss of creativity, the loss of, you know, of being a productive person. Someone that's also on that same trajectory could say, I don't want to experience that either. I am going to intervene and I'm going to end my life because I don't want that either.
Yeah, and look, I mean, my philosophy is, you don't need to go that direction. There are many other things. There's no antibiotics. There's no medical interventions. There's no there's the option of not eating and drinking, which are much easier to do, in my opinion. And actually, I think leave a different approach. So I don't see that. I think many people have a deceptive view. This is a quick, painless, guaranteed way to exit. It turns out not to be any of those things. It's not guaranteed. There are lots of, even in the, again, in the Netherlands, it can often not have problems associated with it. I think from most people's standpoint, they have the wrong view about it. You know, they think it's people who are in extreme pain, people get a quick, easy exit. That's not the scenario. And I think people have not thought with the evidence that we have about euthanasia-assisted suicide.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ezekiel Emanuel. He's a bioethicist, in fact, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. And we are talking about life and death and an article that he has in The Atlantic saying that when he reaches the age of 75, he doesn't want medical treatments. If he gets a diagnosis of cancer, he doesn't want to get treated for it. He doesn't want screenings. He doesn't want tests. He wants to just sort of let nature take its course, if I can use that cliche there. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of this idea, and how does that apply to your life? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Peggy.
Marty, can I make one small refinement to what you said?
Of course.
It's not that I don't want any medical treatments. So what I make clear is I don't want life-sustaining medical treatments. I don't want medical treatments that where the rationale is it'll extend your life. If I need palliative treatment for extreme pain or shortness of breath, I'm okay with that.
Fair enough. Let me get Peggy from Havertown to join us on Radio Times. Peggy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to comment on Dr. Emanuel's story about going to the physician who refused to listen to him about the prostate screening.
Mm-hmm.
I find this rather outrageous that providers feel that they can make these decisions for their patients. And I would encourage consumers to not take that kind of not take that from their providers, that they should choose providers who are going to listen to them and respect their wishes in all medical decisions, but certainly these end-of-life decisions. I think that the consumer's perspective, the individual perspective, has to be respected by the providers.
Peggy, thanks for the call.
I couldn't agree with you more, and as I make clear in the article, and as was the case in this episode, when the doctor called me up with the result, I basically hung up on him.
Wow.
Because he did the test for himself, not for me. And I agree with you. Doctors, we all need to, you know, it's patients' bodies, it's patients' lives. And in this case, it's not like I didn't know the data. I'm an oncologist. I knew the data as well, if not better than he did. And I had thought through my position on PSAs pretty clearly.
But, you know, you're one of the country's leading healthcare experts, and you have a doctor that's...
And I couldn't get my wishes.
And you
wishes.
Couldn't get your doctor to... Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think that tells us a little something about our healthcare system. We have an email from Christopher. He says, to what extent does Dr. Emanuel believe the long-term financial viability of the affordable care system relies on persuading more Americans to avoid the healthcare system when their ailments are likely to be the most expensive?
Not at all. And again, as I make clear in the article, this is a very personal article. It's not about rationing. It's not about how we ought to allocate our resources. I teach a course at the University of Pennsylvania on the future of the American healthcare system. And one of the points I make is our challenge in the United States is not how much money we need to spend on healthcare. We're spending $3 trillion on healthcare. We have more than enough money in the system. It's the wisdom with which we're spending it. Unfortunately, deliver a lot of unnecessary tests and treatments that don't add to quality of life. Often when we have choices between clinically equivalent treatments, we often pick the more expensive one rather than the cheaper one that's exactly the same from a clinical and health standpoint. We have a lot of room to go. We don't need to be talking about rationing or not giving treatments to 75-year-olds in order to save money so that the system's viable. That's just completely unnecessary. And I make that point in my class. I make that point in my book on the healthcare system. And this article has absolutely nothing to do with the fiscal viability of the American healthcare system. There is more than enough money in our system now to provide optimal care for every American. That's not our challenge. Our challenge is actually how to implement that.
We do spend a lot of money, though, on end of life care, do we not, in this country?
So we do spend a lot of money on end-of-life care. I've calculated that it's about 10% of total health care spending, and that, you know, we haven't found a reliable way to solve and reduce that amount of spending. I think it's important not to focus on trying to reduce that spending. As I've written in many places, the real key and the real focus has to be on how to make that end-of-life care as comfortable as possible and as meaningful for people as possible. That should be the focus. And, you know, one of the most important ways of doing that is to have a frank conversation with your family about your wishes and have a frank conversation with your doctor and healthcare team about your wishes. And I think that's an important direction. I also have written that we need to assure that there's palliative care services available in every hospital in the country, and when patients go home, those differences, those changes, having the conversation with your healthcare team, having palliative care services available, those are going to be critical to actually making end-of-life care optimal in this country. And I think we should focus on those interventions and not focus on the dollars and cents.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. So are you happy with the response to this article? I mean, it is a conversation starter.
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I don't pay attention that much to the response. Basically, again, to me, the responses fall fallen into three buckets. One is around about a third of the people disagree with me, think I'm crazy. About a third of the people agree with me. Many of those people are caring for people who are have dementia or physical disabilities and agree, as my patient's daughter wrote me. A large number of those people who agree with me are in the health professions. Hmm. And then there's another pot who find it thought-provoking, challenging, makes them very uncomfortable. I wanted to make people uncomfortable. I wanted to make people think. I wanted to make people begin to have this conversation and to think deeply about what makes their life meaningful and how long you have to live to realize that. And, you know, I hope that's a service to people. I hope it makes them really think about what their life is about. And I can't imagine something more important, frankly. And if I've done that, even if I've made you feel uncomfortable and you wish it, I had never written it, I'm not going to apologize for that. I think prompting a discussion about the meaning of life is probably a pretty worthy thing to do.
And I hate to ask this with a minute to go, but let's say at the age of 65, not 75, but 65, you get a diagnosis of cancer. Will you go, you know, full bore?
Again, depends upon the kind of cancer. You can't ask an oncologist that open-ended question.
No, I understand.
Depends upon the kind of cancer, what its prognosis is, what the treatments are. But I would say, again, just playing the odds, probably would get treated for it. But I can't be 100% sure. Again, it would depend upon the particular cancer and prognosis.
Well, on that note, I hear you. Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure always to be with you, Marty.
Well, thanks so much. And the article in The Atlantic is titled, Why I Hope to Die at 75. Although, as we have discussed during this hour, that's a bit of a misleading title, but nonetheless has given us a lot to talk about. Ezekiel Emanuel, Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, with help this week from Shamita Basu. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.